then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's April the 18th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, we've got a pretty full schedule for this week's show. The mainstream media news has been getting spicier and spicier every week for a while now, as America's long, slow slide down into the toxic waste pool slowly increases in mass and speed. First off, we had wild nigger Christopher Dorner going apeshit out there in Los Angeles and whacking a bunch of L.A. cops. Then came the Colorado prison commandant who got whacked, and a so-called white supremacist who may or may not have been involved was shot down on the roadside and stripped down for parts in the hospital before he was even dead. Then we had lawyers dropping dead of lead poisoning in Texas. And now there are things going kaboom in Boston. I'm almost starting to feel like I'm back in Ireland or London in 1992, and it's a good feeling in a way, nostalgic. Now, the first thing I suppose I should go over is to update you folks on the Texas lawyer rubouts that we've been talking about for the past 2 weeks. Well, guess what? Looks like there was no white resistance involved after all. No Aryan Brotherhood assassins slipping through the tumbleweeds and the dead armadillos on the asphalt to blow away good old boy lawyers with American flags in their lapels, after all. Nope. After all that official sound and fury trying to blame the dead lawyers on us wicked, evil white supremacists, it now turns out that the two Kaufman County District Attorneys were killed by one of their own kind. A corrupt judge named Eric Williams, whom they prosecuted for stealing computer equipment, of all things, from his office in the courthouse. Now, this is a minor piece of corruption, especially in a place like Texas, and it's tempting to chuckle at these two guys in the expensive power suits getting blown away over a few computer monitors. But I suspect that this business with the stolen computer equipment was just the culmination of one of these long-running, bitter inter-office feuds and intrigues and power struggles which distinguishes every institution in our society. Now, this feud between the district attorney's office and this one judge was probably going on for years. And then the judge got careless, and the DA, Mike McClellan, caught him nicking the monitors and taking them home in his truck, and prosecuted him and got him disbarred or debenched or whatever they do to judges who get caught. Now, the judge, Eric Williams, has now been arrested for, quote-unquote, making terroristic threats, which is one of those legal charges that can mean any damn thing they want it to mean. That's just something that the cops can hold somebody on in lieu of whatever real charges they want to prefer. Now, this Williams guy is being held on a $3 million bond, although he hasn't been charged with the murders yet, so I'd say it's a pretty safe bet that the Texas Rangers have got their man. I will be very interested to see how this one shapes up, if indeed we are allowed to know how it shapes up. It may just drop off the radar. Okay, now on to the big news of the week, the Boston baked bombs. I should mention that I'm recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, April the 16th, and so once again, by the time I even upload this podcast to the northwestfront.org website tomorrow night, all of this may be dated and no longer operative. I wish we had some kind of proper nightly newscast. But here goes, based on what we know now, which is precious little. First off, the unnamed quote-unquote Saudi national who was arrested on the scene after the bombings seems to be getting airbrushed out of the picture. This may be something sinister, or it may be that the Boston flat feet simply made a mistake and scooped up some poor old Apu from the Quickie Mart who was in the area and who was running around going, "Hala, hala, 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 hala." He may or may not have been involved. If I was a Muslim and a large explosion went off near me, I'd probably start running too. However, the liberal state-controlled media are now inclining to the theory that this Arab guy was not involved and the bombs were not set off by Al-Qaeda or Muslim terrorism. Oh, no, 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 not at all. Because, you see, that would involve admitting that Islamic terrorism in this country actually exists. Just like Mexican drug cartels operating in this country actually exist. And that can't be allowed. Although, in this case, I have to admit, I'm not sure that genuine Islamic terrorism here in this country does exist, or has ever existed. I won't go into all the very serious and legitimate doubts that a lot of very intelligent people have regarding the true provenance of 9/11. And I won't point out the fact that the few genuine instances of Muslims doing harm in this country have been things like the Fort Hood shootings, where some Muslim psychiatrist found that he could no longer support a military machine that was slaughtering his own people like cattle, and he flipped out. Now, flipping out is not terrorism. American society is half insane at the best of times, and anyone who lives here is always going to be a little nuts. Now, plus, most of the other so-called terrorist plots by Muslims have been teenage kids or Quickie Mart Apus who have been framed by the FBI, who surrounded them with five or six undercover operatives at a time posing as an Al-Qaeda cell, and they provided poor dumb old Apu or Muhammad with a fake explosive belt made out of Play-Doh so they can arrest him walking into a shopping mall or something. Now, for the past 24 hours, the state-controlled liberal media have been desperately trying to pin the bombings in Boston on the Tea Party or else on tax protesters because it was April 15th, or, of course, on wicked and evil white supremacists. Fat liberal slob Michael Moore claims that it was the NRA, although you'd think that pro-gun protesters would use guns. Now, basically, what the media is ginning up is that these bombs were planted by anybody white, male, and Republican who listens to Rush Limbaugh. Now, who actually done it? I have no idea. When the cops and the dictatorship finally get their story straight and present us with a narrative of some kind, it may bear some resemblance to the truth, or it may not, depending on the political needs of the moment. Anyway, the various secret police agencies now have all the excuse they need to go cruising around the countryside, knocking on doors, and trying to get people to talk to them and develop them as informers. The FBI and ATF love events like this because it opens this big, huge case file with all those impressive case numbers and subfiles and sub-investigations, and that means they can pretty much go rummaging around anywhere in anybody's shit and get warrants for the asking, if they feel like bothering with warrants at all. And nobody can say boo to them because they are investigating the big, bad Boston bombings. Now, do I need to go over the drill once more for when you hear the knock on the door? Now, remember, if they're knocking, they're not planning on arresting you, because if they were going to arrest you, they wouldn't be knocking. They'd be kicking and smashing and screaming and clubbing you to the floor with their rifle butts and sticking gun muzzles into your children's mouths to show how big and brave and tough they are. And if they just knock, you ask, "Do you have a warrant?" If the answer is no, you say, "Get one." And you close the door in their faces. Do not stand there in the doorway, even just to give them five words. Anytime there is any physical interface between yourself and the secret police, you are in danger. Anyway, I've already gone over all this on here before. Here's Gretchen.
Good evening, comrades. This week I decided to do a report on Sir Oswald Mosley. Now, Oswald Mosley was born into the landed gentry in Britain and was sent off to a very swank boarding school as a youngster for his education. And then in 1914, he joined the cavalry to go off to the First World War. And he was involved in that for a short time, but then he got involved with the Air Force. And while he was in the Air Force, he went in for a very hard landing. And then injured ankle very severely, which had already been injured at boarding school during a prank when he leapt out of a window. So he really didn't take enough time to recover. And so when he reenlisted in the army and went into the trenches, he got a case of gangrene. So he had to leave the military permanently on disability, but doctors managed to save his leg. But for the rest of his life, one leg was shorter than the other. So here was Sir Oswald Mosley, rich, aristocratic, ruggedly handsome, and a war hero with an injury. And so that made him very socially desirable. And in the 20s, he decided that he was going to go into politics. Now, at first, he starts out early on in Parliament as a Whig. And then he goes into the Conservative Party. Now, this turns out to be a theme throughout his life. He's always changing parties. He's always looking for the best way to help the unemployed, because that's really his major concern in going into Parliament. At around this time in his life, he gets married to another aristocrat by the name of Cynthia. He's always a very popular man. He's always involved in things like parties and in social life. But he's always interested in the new way of doing things. And he's not really interested in class divisions. And he always wants to really get things done in Parliament. And he gets very fed up with the slow pace of British Parliament. What happens then is he thinks about becoming an independent. Then he goes into the Labour Party, and the Conservatives really never forgive him for this, but the Labour Party is very excited to have him because he's really more educated than a lot of people in Labour. Now, he's in Labour for a while, but then he develops something called the New Party. At one point, as a member of the New Party, he might have joined something called the National Coalition, even though he resigns from Parliament as a member of the New Party. Now, a lot of his friends, once he goes into the New Party, think that potentially he's drifting into fascism, and they really decide that they want nothing to do with him. But he continues on that vein, deciding to go into alternative politics. And then he actually decides to become a fascist. He decides to go off to Italy to study with Mussolini. And he's encouraged by someone by the name of Lord Rothermere. At this point, his wife is rather upset with him because she's going through a very difficult pregnancy. But eventually, she comes around and she actually designs the flag that today we associate with Mosley, the lightning bolt. Now, Mosley develops at this point a uniform consisting of the famous black shirt. He has a lot of meetings, and unfortunately, these meetings tend to generate a lot of fight. But it's kind of a double-edged sword because even though Mosley wants to be known for his economic ideas, when these meetings generate fights, he gets more publicity. And some of the people that were generating these fights were communist Jewish agitators. But even at that, the Mosley movement, compared to other movements, is fairly mild when it comes to anti-Semitism. It was only mentioned really in passing by Mosley, although it was mentioned somewhat more vigorously by a cohort by the name of Mick Clark. So Mosley is doing his public speaking, but then in 1936, The government really starts to crack down on both the uniforms and the paramilitary organizations. And at around this time, tragedy strikes the Mosley family because Cynthia Mosley ends up dying of complications of appendicitis. And so this is a very great blow for Oswald, and he throws himself even more into the movement at this point. A few years later, Oswald marries Diana Mitford, who is one of the Mitford sisters who are connected with Hitler and with National Socialism, so that deepens his ties to the movement. In 1940, the British government begins its war with Germany, so the British government becomes very suspicious of Mosley. They're suspicious that he's been influenced by continental fascists, and they examine his financial records to see if there's been any major contributions from continental fascists. And at first they're not able to find any, but then they do find later on, when it's really too late to matter, there is some evidence of Mosley getting money from Mussolini. However, in 1940, even though they don't have really a lot of grounds to arrest Mosley, they do, and they also arrest his wife. This arrest is primarily based on the fear that Mosley would cooperate with the Germans if they invaded. And it's true that Mosley does think that the German military is very powerful, and he was very much impressed by them during his time in the army in World War I. However, Mosley tells all the members of the services that they are to obey their orders, and he tells his followers that if Britain is invaded, that they should do everything they can to resist. However, the Britons do have a fear that he might cooperate with the Germans either before or after a successful invasion. But the author points out that cooperation after a successful invasion is not really considered treason because once your country has been defeated, you really don't have a choice but to cooperate in some respects with the regime. That's sadly quite true. But during the time that Mosley is in prison, he reads the Greek classics and he also reads Goethe, and it's a time of great mind expansion for Mosley. And he's always trying to reconcile democracy with fascism, and he also gets more interested in Christianity at this time. Now, in 1943, he's let out for humanitarian reasons because he starts to develop health problems. And after a brief respite, he continues with his public speaking, and he develops ideas about a unified Europe, and he also wants the Russian-American troops to leave Europe. And he also talks about the resources that Africa has, and he wants to make 2/3 of Africa white and 1/3 black. And he wants Africa because of all the resources, no doubt, for industry. So he's a real visionary, and in 1962, he goes to a conference in Vienna that is a kind of intellectual conference for fascists. So he remains very much within the movement, and even into his 70s, he goes on television a lot and does a lot of public speaking. So really kind of a tragic figure, someone who's very much in a way hampered by his time and place and sort of class restrictions, and he's always trying to break out, and he never quite does, but he's always trying to do the best that he's able to in his circumstances. I found this book was one that could have used some editing and some more consolidation in my view, but I still found it was an interesting study. So I hope you enjoyed this evening's discussion. So thank you very much for listening.
On Saturday, April the 20th, it will be the 124th birthday of Adolf Hitler. A little bit later in this podcast, I'll be speaking about my own National Socialist worldview, but In honor of the occasion, I'll be playing some NS music selections for you this week. Now, this was Adolf Hitler's personal favorite marching song, and it was traditionally played in his presence when he entered a room or came onto a reviewing stand or assumed the podium to speak, whatever. During the time of the Third Reich, this was kind of like Hail to the Chief. It's called the Badenweiler March. I have always known that Hitler was right. Even when I was a child and had no idea what National Socialism was all about, I seemed to have an instinctive recognition that all was not right around me in the world I was growing up in, and that anyone whom the authorities and shot-callers of my world feared, hated, and reviled as much as Adolf Hitler had to have something going for him. When I played army with the other boys in my Burlington, North Carolina neighborhood, I always wanted to fight on the German side. Nor was this unusual. There were other boys like myself who drew swastikas on their schoolbook covers and rooted for the Germans when watching television shows like Combat or The Gallant Men. There was something in the shape of that Teutonic coal scuttle helmet that thrilled our very souls. I've often wondered how this could be. When we were so young, we could have no idea of the issues involved with the war or what the NSDAP was all about. And in fact, we were constantly subjected to a barrage of anti-Nazi propaganda in a time when the war was a very recent memory. It could be reincarnational, of course, but I know many of you don't subscribe to that. I think that at least some of it was because there is a kind of innate moral faculty in our people, which white people are born with, which instinctively recognizes the difference between truth and lies, between right and wrong. It's a pity more of us can't retain that faculty into our adult lives. Once I grew old enough to begin to understand things a bit, my earlier childish admiration and fascination with the Third Reich and the dynamic figure of Adolf Hitler grew as I came to realize that my initial instincts had been correct. Now, for one thing, even as a child reading my first books on the Second World War, I never bought into the Holocaust myth. I had no idea what the word logistics meant, but the idea that a nation fighting for its very existence would devote immense resources, manpower, and time to a pointless act of mass extermination was palpably ridiculous. I wrote the Holocaust story off as typical war propaganda, and I read on. When I was about 10, I met my first German war veteran, a friend of a friend of our family, who was a handsome and talented middle-aged artist from Greensboro, whom I will call Johann. I didn't know it, but Johann had been a Fallschirmjäger during the war. That's German for paratrooper. At a cocktail party one night, some loudmouth redneck was holding forth on how he'd whooped up on old Hitler and won the war single-handedly. He was describing some battle in Italy and said, "And then the goddamn Nazi paratroopers came raining down out in the sky." And Johann looked up quietly from his corner and says, "Yeah, I remember. They jumped on you. You ran away." The redneck fool was noticeably silent for the rest of the evening. I was fascinated. Here was a man who had actually worn that helmet, that uniform with the eagle and swastika I'd seen so often in movies and on TV. As soon as I could, I got Johann off to one side and asked him, "Did you ever meet Adolf Hitler?" And he smiled and he says, "No, not personally, but I saw him many times. I'm from Nuremberg, where they had the big rallies, and every year the Führer would drive beneath the window of my house in his open car." Once he looked up and saw me in the window and smiled. Later on, I was a Hitler youth, and I heard him speak. Johann was silent for a while, and then he said, "When you heard his words, you knew there was a God." Years later, I heard the words of Adolf Hitler, and I knew. I hear them still. What was Adolf Hitler's secret? The secret that enabled an unknown soldier with no money or influence and only a few friends from his army days to triumph against all the odds and become the leader of Germany after only 14 years of struggle. What is this secret which we in these dark days for our race might learn and use to help us in our own struggle? His secret was really very simple. His secret was that he genuinely cared for and loved his people in a selfless way. So it was that he devoted the whole of his adult life to his people and lived by the principles which he and the political organization he created and led propounded in public. In his own private life, he was frugal. He was always spontaneous with people and never once tried to cultivate or uphold any sort of public image. Unlike virtually any other political leader before or since, Adolf Hitler really was a man of the people. Hitler triumphed against all the odds because over the years of his struggle, more and more of his people liked him and felt he was a good man who had their interests at heart. He did have some extraordinary gifts, such as his ability to speak in public, his resolute determination, and his superb memory. But most of all, he was a simple, unspoilt, and uncomplicated man. He won his victory because of his own personal character, and the foundation of his personal character was this simple love of his people. Indeed, his very reason for living was to care for and help his people. The love which Adolf Hitler felt and expressed for his folk is what made him so popular and so loved by the Germans of the time. And it is the truth about and the memory of his love that his Zionist enemies have striven so hard to destroy with their hateful, stupid lies about him, about his movement, and about his government. Now, if we want to express the truth about Adolf Hitler, we have to express the genuine and selfless love and concern he felt for his race and nation. The secret we can and indeed must learn from him is this elemental, uncomplicated, and genuine love for our people. This love comes before any political program. This love comes before any rhetoric and before any propaganda. This love comes before any political demonstration. This love comes before any thought or mention of hating enemies. And above all, it is this love for our own kind which should and must motivate us to act in a political way. Now, if we feel and try to express this love, this concern and care for our own, we can and will win. For it is, to some degree, the lack of this love which has made us fail in the past 70 years. As I keep saying, we cannot join the movement because we want to get something out of it rather than put something into it. That never seems to work out. We have to join this struggle because we know that the world has to change. So, just what is this Nazi business, the National Socialist philosophy that Adolf Hitler bestowed on the world? National Socialism is a worldview for white people, based on the ideas and concepts of Adolf Hitler. Hitler was, however, a man of his time and place, a time and place that no longer exists. And his worldview was therefore in need of a translator, which it found in the late U.S. Navy Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, who adapted National Socialism to the political and racial conditions of the United States. Rockwell was kind of our St. Peter in that he took a localized creed and system of thought and belief and brought it to the center of the known world of his time, just as Peter did for Christianity. And he made it universal. Owing to the tragic and unnecessary suffering which took place during the Second World War, and because the evil bastards who control the Western democratic world to this day maintain an interest in obscuring and concealing the truth, 70 years after the war's end, massive misconceptions still exist in America today about what National Socialism was and is. Now, the National Socialist body of belief is founded on three principles. The first is natural order. National Socialists believe that the universe is governed by natural laws. In order for man to be happy and successful, he must first learn what these laws are and then follow them. We believe that man is a part of the natural world and that he is in no way separate from or distinct from it. Because of this, we believe that society should be structured in accordance with the laws of nature and not in opposition to them, as is the case today. The second principle is racial idealism. Racial idealism is based on love of one's own people, not hatred for others. It means placing the interests and welfare of the racial community to which you belong ahead of your own personal interests and desires. As racial idealists, we have no wish to harm, exploit, or persecute any other racial groups, despite a persistent media propaganda campaign of abuse and deliberate falsification to the contrary. We are only interested in protecting our own people against extinction, a fate all too likely if nothing is done about present conditions in America. We believe that all men are not created equal. Just as every individual has his own strengths and weaknesses, so each race has certain qualities which make it different from other races. We believe that the white or Aryan race has the right to maintain its own biological, cultural, and political independence and integrity, and that we have the right to control our own destiny. We also believe that the white race has the right to defend itself against all physical, economic, and spiritual assaults, no matter where they come from. Now, the third founding principle of the National Socialist worldview is the upward development of the white race. We want to do more than just defend our race. We want to see it improve. This can be done by encouraging a high birth rate among those sections of the white population which are the healthiest, strongest, and most intelligent. At the same time, our science should work to eliminate hereditary weaknesses and defects among our people. Our goal is that each new generation of white children will be better than the one before it. I won't take up any more of your time with this because I know that many of you listening to this aren't National Socialists, or at least not primarily so. I'll simply close with an observation that I have made a couple of times already in my novels. We have a number of other belief systems and tendencies within white nationalism, and sometimes those belief systems tend to come into conflict, especially where religion is concerned. I believe that when we finally attain independence in our own Northwest American Republic, it is the National Socialists among us who will provide a necessary center and unifying cohesion for the Republic, and that we will actually serve as a force for moderation among our citizens. and I've always thought that the Fuhrer would have found that funny as hell. Between 1914 and 1948, untold millions of German men, women, and children died in the service of Western civilization. Some on the Western Front during the First War, some on the Eastern Front, some in the firestorms of Dresden and Hamburg and Cologne, some starved by the British blockade in the First War, some murdered by deranged and hate-filled Jews after the Second. This is a song from the Napoleonic Wars, which is traditionally played at the gravesites of fallen German soldiers. But it wasn't just the soldiers of Germany who fought and died for us all. It was the entire German nation. Okay, this is being recorded on Wednesday afternoon now, and the Matt Drudge Report has just announced that the Boston police have arrested some kind of nigger or Middle Easterner or other dark-skinned individual as a suspect in the Marathon bombings. I really wish I had the time and the technical ability to do a regular news commentary, if not in real time, then at least every night or so. Now, this may in fact come about, by the way. Greatly expanding our Radio Free Northwest podcast capacity is definitely on the cards. It's just that certain things have to happen first. Oh, another news item. Apparently, somebody has sent an envelope with traces of the nerve toxin ricin to the White House, addressed to the dictator himself, which is, of course, a stupid thing to do, since I don't think anybody could be so dumb as to believe that Barry opens his own mail. Now, that would need a letter opener, and I doubt that his Jewish handlers like Axelrod and Sunstein allow him to have anything sharp. That story's still breaking as I babble, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's just a hoax designed to get some of the public attention back onto Barry's caramel-colored ass and his gun control and immigration agenda, because he's jealous of the publicity that the Boston bombing has taken away from him. Okay, let's try to get back on track. Several weeks ago, one of our comrades asked me to do a sort of tutorial on what Lenin called the conspiratorial method, on the grounds that most of you genuinely do not understand what I'm talking about, because you don't have the cultural background or the historical knowledge to understand it. You're 20th and 21st century Americans, and you're just not trained in how to think that way. The sort of thing I will be talking about comes as second nature to Europeans and Asians and Latin Americans and even some African niggers, but white people in North America have forgotten all this stuff. The best way to put the question seems to be, if we're not going to dress up a small handful of us in strange-looking costumes and stand on a street corner waving signs while human scum scream obscenities and throw things at us, and if we're not going to pick up a gun or load up a truck full of fertilizer and play NBA, which we're too timid and frightened and lacking in focus to do, then what are we supposed to do? Okay, let me run it down once again from the top. Because we are exercising constitutional rights which the dictatorship does not want us to exercise, we're subject to harassment, illegal surveillance, interference, fabricated evidence and perjury, and in some cases assault and murder on the part of the dictator's servants. In order to avoid this, we have to select various kinds of modus operandi involving concealment, deception, and covert action so that we can not only continue to exist, but so that we can actually function and place our ideas and our beliefs before the public. Now, the fact that we have the perfect legal right to do this does not matter at all, because the various agencies of the dictatorship do not obey their own laws, and we have no way to make them do so. The one method which we have to compel them to obey their own laws and grant us our rights, the Second Amendment, is the one which we are too timid and frightened to use. The Founding Fathers gave us the Second Amendment. They did not give us the courage to use it. Now that leaves the conspiratorial method. The secret to successful use of the conspiratorial method on our part lies in two things. A, insofar as possible, keeping our identities unknown to the people with power or with permission from power, who would persecute us and do us harm. And B, at the same time, effectively conveying our forbidden ideas and beliefs to the white public, especially the white public here in the homeland. That's where it counts. One contact brought to northwestfront.org here in the 3.5 state operational area is worth 10 outside that area. There is going to be a big hoo-ha within our ranks over exactly how we define the term effectively. On the one hand, there will be a lot of people who insist that they're giving effective assistance to the Northwest American Republic by remaining located where they are and tapping on their computers in some manner or another. Okay, first off, I have to say, yes, there are a few of you out there who are doing really worthwhile stuff on your computers, and you're not resident in the homeland. You know who you are. If you're making YouTube videos, if you're making business cards, if you're doing leaflets, if you're doing graphics, if you are doing other stuff on your computer where you are that really does help us here in the Northwest, then many, many thanks to you. But again, I say, you guys know who you are. You know if you're pulling your own weight or not. But a lot of you, let's face it, are engaging in a popular internet game or pastime. You're trying to find some excuse, some rationalization, some way to be part of the movement and part of the Northwest magic and pretend you're NVA volunteers without ever actually having to move to the Northwest and thus incur risk and inconvenience or the possibility that somebody might find out who you are, which is something that white Americans have been taught all their lives to avoid. Now, these peoples claim that they're helping from behind their computers where they are without having to actually relocate to the homeland. It's kind of our variation of the old American saying, don't work hard, work smart. Now, this is just us being American white boys. Now, whatever it is, from sports to NASCAR to politics to personal relationships, American white boys have been raised from birth to try and get in as much play as possible without paying, to enjoy as many thrills and spills and chills as they can without ever having to put anything on the table. Now, I no longer get mad about this, at least not too much. It's just us. It's who we are. It's who the kikes have made us. Now, we can change from within and transform our character, but most of us don't make the effort because we see no need to, since we don't really believe that change or victory is possible, so why bother? Or else we're just too goddamn lazy to change our behavior. And that, too, is us. It's who us white boys are these days. God, we're bone idle, physically and morally. I know I'm wandering off into obscurity again. I warned you guys last week that that would happen a lot during these segments. Okay, let's drag my pale ass kicking and screaming back to the point. Conspiratorial method. As it happens, this morning I gave our people an exercise in the practical application of the conspiratorial method. I don't as yet know how many of you are going to participate or how well it's going to go, but I'll give you an example of this one activity precisely because it is something that all you slackers out there who are sitting behind your computers can get involved in. Now, as I have explained several times previously on this show, a large part of the problem that the Northwest Front faces in getting our ideas in front of the people who need to hear them is the fact that nobody knows we are here. They do not know that we are here because we are blacklisted from the mainstream media. We don't get reported unless somebody bleeds, usually us. Now, I won't retell the Rachel Maddow story again, but I will mention that once again this week, a documentary film crew approached me, this time from National Geographic of all outfits, trying to slither names out of me of our quote-unquote members in Montana so they can wander around Kalispell stalking us like nature show hosts tracking wildlife across the Serengeti or whatever. I never get any of these offers for serious interviews about our ideas, but I do fairly often get these strange news crews, usually so-called independents or freelancers, which means that you never know who's actually signing their checks. And usually from foreign countries where apparently the blacklist doesn't apply. Now, they never want to talk to me or apparently even smear me personally. They want me to introduce them to what they term our ordinary rank and file memories, especially in Montana. For some reason, they're obsessed with Montana, and they want me to induce these alleged members of ours to let camera crews into their homes to film them, again, like they're filming some kind of exotic wildlife. And I think we all know what the finished product there would look like. But not one serious contact request for an interview or analytical piece in the 5 years that the NF has been in existence. Now, the only such interview I've done with any outside media since then was when Jeff Hughes was murdered, and the Vice.com interview in England. Rachel Maddow didn't even bother to contact me or April Gady or anyone before she went off on us back in 2011 over the bionic backpack. Once more, I need to grab myself by the collar and pull myself back to the point. Now, when the Boston-baked bombs went kablooey a few days ago, there was all kinds of immediate speculation in the state-controlled media that wicked white supremacists were responsible, or else, quote-unquote, right-wing extremists were responsible, which is an even more meaningless term. These idiots consider anyone who has a copy of the Constitution to be a terrorist. And the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is responsible for the ideological indoctrination of the militarized police units that have sprung up over the country, considers practicing Baptists and Roman Catholics to be dangerous religious fanatics. There were even a couple of articles in the ultra-liberal Salon magazine yesterday by an imbecile named David Sirota about how, quote-unquote, we must all hope that the bomber, when arrested, is an American white male, because if this does turn out to be Al-Qaeda or some weirded-out Occupy nigga, it will set back the liberal causes of gun control and immigration reform, i.e. disarming whites and registering 30 million new Democrat voters, etc. Anyway, what I asked people on our e-list to do is infiltrate the comments sections of news articles of this kind, as if we were Democrats ourselves. And by the way, the ruling party admits that they do this to spin the news and manipulate public opinion using Twitter and persona management software, so forth and so on. Anyway, I asked everybody to get onto every comments section they could, under whatever pretense they could, using false names to register under, and somehow or other insert a link to northwestfront.org. You should pretend to be outraged. Look, I give out violent, evil, white supremacists. See, there they are, right there, right there. Yes, yes, there they are. Northwestfront.org, everybody look and see how violent and awful and wicked and evil they are. Ah! The object being to bring as many left-wing liberal assholes as possible to the party website and freak them out so totally that for a short time, at least, the blacklist will, hopefully, slip, and we go at least a little bit viral as all the lefty lib morons tweet the northwestfront.org link to one another saying, look, look, here they are, violent, evil, white supremacists. Yes, they're not just mythical creatures like leprechauns and dinosaurs and Eskimos. They really do exist. Ah! Okay, you get the idea. Now, let's say that before the state-controlled media's containment protocols against banned people and ideas can kick in and the blackout can be reimposed, we're able to generate an additional, 10,000 hits over and above what we would normally get through this little subterfuge. Of those hits, I grant you, 9,900 of them will be completely useless from people that we neither need nor want. Now, the remaining 100 of those hits would be from the people that we need to reach. That's 100 more white people who now know that we exist and who will read the site and ask for further information and maybe order a Northwest novel or two. That's 100 white people who might turn out to be part of that first 1,000 Class A migrants that we have to have. This is what is known as the conspiratorial method. Like in judo, we use the enemy's own weight and power and momentum against him. We exploit his mental and emotional weak points, in this case, his insane hatred of anything white and male. We do so in order to slip our ideas past the hard outer shell, the fortifications that he has erected around white people and white people's minds, and sort of jab the racial truth and the ideal of white freedom in a land of our own right into unsuspecting and unprotected white skulls full of mush like an ice pick, before the socially engineered shields around those skulls full of mush can snap on. We do so without breaking any laws, but in a covert and deceptive manner that, for a time at least, until they figure out what we're doing, can slip by the enemy's security protocols. This is an example of the conspiratorial method. Now, I suppose I should round off this final segment of Hitler's Birthday podcast with the usual scratchy mono recording of the Horst Wessel song from the 1930s, but I won't. It's such a magnificent song, and I so badly want to find a properly mixed, modern, stereophonic recording of it. I've been busting my butt for years trying to locate a modern version of Die Fahnenhoek somewhere on the net, but no luck. And this isn't really surprising, since any band or chorus that were to play and sing even a few bars of this song would get a 10-year prison stretch, especially in Germany. So I tend to go with more modern and better recordings of other older songs when I go for my German classics. Now, this is a song that was composed in the 1840s by a Swiss poet, ironically, when Germany was being threatened with invasion by France. It was sung in 1871 when the Germans handed the French their ass on a platter, and then again in the First and Second World Wars. It became kind of the unofficial German national anthem after Deutschland über alles. It's not exactly illegal in Germany today, but if they catch you singing it, you'll probably notice some funny noises on your phone and strange men in trench coats following you around. Anyway, this is called Die Wacht am Rhein, The Watch on the Rhine. We'll be right back. I'm going to close now with a message from Cindy Steele, the wife of imprisoned attorney, writer, and internet commentator Edgar J. Steele. I think the best thing I can do here is simply read this press release without comment. Dear Edgar Steele supporters, my thank you for your support is long overdue, but please know that in my heart I thank you every day and appreciate your support more than any of these words can express. Life has been relentlessly hard since Ed's false arrest and wrongful conviction, and when I lost my mom, it pretty much took the wind out of my sails. My heart is still heavily saddened, for I've had to endure the loss of two best friends, my husband by a criminal government who went to great lengths to take him away, and my mom through death. However, I'm pulling myself up to continue the fight to bring my husband home. What I want you to know is that along with praying, it is your support through supportive letters and or donations that helps me to stay strong, for I know that I do not stand alone as I fight for justice for Ed and for all of us. I realize that I've been far too quiet on matters pertaining to Ed's current situation, but I assure you that I'm out here fighting for my husband's freedom. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot to report, as the appeal process is slow, and a lot of time is spent waiting for filings, responses, replies, and answers from the attorneys on both sides of the courts. It is just one of the many things that has been a source of frustration, but anyone in this type of situation is at the mercy of our injustice or just us system. With regard to the appeal, it has been in front of the Ninth Circuit Court since January, and we're waiting for their response. I've been told that maybe we would receive a response in 2 to 3 months, but there is no set time, and 6 months or longer is more likely. Because of a ruling on another case, we have already lost one of the appealable issues. Of course, we pray and still have hope that the remaining two issues will finally get Ed some justice and, for starts, get him a new trial. Now, there has been a lot of concern about the lack of any contact with Ed, especially in regards to his mail. I can tell you that for the most part, he is not getting most of his mail. I've had supporters contact me about their mail being returned. I've had mail I've sent to him returned. Ed told me that he isn't getting most of the mail that anyone has sent, including any legal mail. Apparently, most of that same undelivered mail to him has not been returned to those who sent it either. If he does receive any mail, it typically isn't given to him for 2 to 3 weeks from the time the prison has received the mail. It doesn't matter that the federal prison's policy states that they are to receive their mail within 24 hours. It is just one of the many ways that they utilize to inflict further punishment. Until March 17, 2013, my main contact with Ed was through email and phone calls about every 3 to 4 days. Each phone call was only 15 minutes long, but it is the best part of my day when I get to talk to him. I get to hear his voice, and for that brief moment I get relief from the worry over his health and general well-being. Unfortunately, from now on he will only be able to call me once a month due to being back in solitary confinement, the hole, for probably an extended period of time. It is for his own protection and by his choice that he is in the hole because of being assaulted by another prisoner and receiving threats. As he has requested, hopefully they will transfer him back to the west side of the prison, where he felt safer, or to a medical facility where he could hopefully get some proper medical care. Fortunately, he was able to send me a note recently, which basically tells you what I've just relayed. The Edgar Steele Defense Fund, the nonprofit board, and I have been working to produce a DVD entitled Witness to the Persecution, The Plot to Silence Edgar Steele. It was our hope to have it completed for release by now and to send a complimentary copy to those that have so generously donated to Ed's Defense Fund. However, some technical complications have held up the completion of the DVD, so it'll be sent out as soon as possible. With this said, I again thank everyone for their support. And I pray that one day Ed will come home and we can all enjoy his company. I pray for your safety as well because you've been sticking your neck out to support Ed. I pray that all of us can stay safe during these times of peril. Signed, Cindy G. Steele. Our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.